Welcome to The Rink, your weekly source for hockey talk without the entitlement. I'm James Tapley Graylian. This week I'm talking to Ryan Classic of The Classic blog. We're going to discuss the NHL standings and what kind of point systems the NHL should be using, and his Ottawa Senators. Plus, I have a cold. That's all coming up on The Rink. Standings are the big topic right now, it seems, and with so many games going into overtime these days, it seems like a third to half of the games are going into overtime and turning into three-point games. I wanted to talk to somebody who's been doing some of the work about this, and I'm turning to Ryan Mance, a.k.a. Ryan Classic, who has the blog, the Classic blog, which is at ryanclassic.net. Hi, Ryan.
How are you doing today?
Hey, excellent. Thanks. Right now, I know that you're doing a big kind of stats overview on many different systems of statistics. Even today, as we record this, there was a post on Puck Daddy, which I'll link to on The Rink, about the various systems, and that basically, I guess general frustration over the way that statistics are playing out these days. And obviously the biggest thing that they could do, since the NHL after the lockout changed actually the system of what how a game would end going out of overtime, is the next move possibly to change the way that points are attributed for wins, losses, ties, shootout losses, overtime wins, and the like. So I wanted to talk to you some about some of the systems and how they would change the outcomes of what's going on. So the current system, of course, that everyone's familiar with is basically the 2-point/3-point game, which is 2 points for a win, 1 point for an overtime loss or shootout loss, and no points for a regulation win. So, and this is generally referred to as the pity point, right?
Pity point, or my preferred term, the charity point. Like, good for you. You managed to get there in overtime. You get a gold star and also a point.
Now, there's, you know, the problem, of course, was, and everybody thought that the shootout was kind of going to solve this, was that people wouldn't, you know, teams wouldn't play for the tie, that people would play for the win in regulation or, you know, even in overtime, so that they didn't have to get to what's generally considered a skills competition. And that doesn't seem to be the case these days. What so we have a few other systems that are, you know, that are available, I guess, or that have been kicked around. You've been kicking around some of these. Let's go through some of these systems. What do we have? Basically, the how would things have worked out at this point in the season if we are still dealing with the old system with no shootout?
Well, no shootout system. There's two things you've got to consider. First of all, one is that the systems that I put together are counting all shootouts as ties in any system where there's not a shootout. And so while numerically that's correct, a lot of people have pointed out that there's a whole psychology behind it where teams know they're safe going into overtime. So you do end up with way, way, way more overtime games than you would expect. But effectively, the moment you start removing the shootout, you get more ties, which also leads to more wins. But because the losses that are in the standings right now are regulation losses, those don't change. So you really just see the win totals for each team drop bit by bit by bit. The teams that are really, really, really strong, the Washingtons, the San Jose's, I guess what used to be the Detroit's, or also Chicago and whatnot, really, when they're dominating, they don't change much in the standings. So what you really get is the middle guys. The most perfect, really, example of this is the Dallas, Nashville, and Vancouver scenario. Dallas is kind of well-known for ending up in the shootout a lot.
Yeah.
Whereas Vancouver's done an excellent job the last time I looked at it, I don't think it's changed since then. They've only gone to 2 overtime games and won both of them in the shootout. So the moment that you try to adjust the score and get rid of the cherry point, well, they just lose 2 points total. Whereas a team like Nashville would lose more than that.
Mm-hmm.
Funny thing about Dallas, though, is that while, yeah, they've gone to the shootout a lot, 7 times as of December 9th when I first did this year's standings, they only won once.
Yikes.
So if you take their 7 games and you convert them to ties, they really only lose 1 point, because 6 of them they lost, they only got the 1 point anyway. So Dallas actually kind of sits in the middle. But as you start removing the shootout, and as you start removing points for overtime losses, Vancouver steadily rises, because Vancouver's kind of stuck in this spot where they are playing at a pace and a style that, you know, teams used to play in. They go for the regulation win.
Mm-hmm.
So they end up getting punished when other teams are getting the extra point. As a result, right now they are a, quote, above 500 team, and they're not in a playoff spot. So they'll lose a game properly, and a team like Dallas or a team like Nashville will lose a game not so properly, going into the shootout, going into overtime. And Vancouver suffers for it.
Right.
Under pretty much any other system I've tried, Vancouver is a playoff team.
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at the top 8 of 15 teams, you know, more than half of your teams in your conference making the playoffs, and currently Vancouver sits with 16-0, so they've won 4 games more than they have lost, then that should say that they're winner chicken dinner and they're in there.
And if you go back as far as some of the older systems, like the old win-loss tie where, you know, you get no points no matter how you lose,
mm-hmm.
then they're 18-16-2, which is still above 500.
Right.
But then you've got a team, again, like Dallas, and I picked on them for their actually crap shootout record. But you can see there they have 11 games that they have counted as overtime losses.
Right.
So they have a ridiculous-looking 15-9 record when really it's 15-20.
Mm-hmm.
So back in December 9, when I did my initial setup, I took a look at what were point percentages, which is what we're using to, right, to calculate whether a team is at 500 or below 500. And the really disturbing thing was that there were 4 teams below 500.
I'm sorry, how many teams below 500?
4.
Wow.
Florida, with a 46% point percentage, Anaheim at 45, Toronto at 43, and then the lowly Carolina Hurricanes at 328. And then you had 6 teams that were at exactly 500, Montreal, the Rangers, Islanders, Flyers, Oilers, and Minnesota Wild. But as soon as you start removing things, you remove the shootout, and suddenly you have 9 teams below 500, and 2 at 500. And then you remove the charity or pity point at all, and go back to the win-loss tie system, and voila, half the league is above 500, and the other half is not.
Hmm.
Which, logically, seems like how it should be.
Right, except unless you have teams like, obviously, like Carolina, who are pretty much, you know, giving away points as, you know, as Christmas gifts this year.
Well, they only do it while on the road, so really, they're a traveling Santa. They're pretty good at home.
That's a good point. I hadn't actually noticed that they've only won 1 game on the road so far. Yikes.
Well, I've been an Ottawa fan since day one, and I remember the first season of a 1-41 road record. So to see another team suffering even remotely like that kind of makes me happy.
You know, Scott Wasilewski brought that up on the show also. So it's
those were dark years. Those yeah. were very dark years. Got some great players like Yashin and Dag out of them, though.
Well, yeah, but we'll get to the Ottawa Senators, that's for sure. So So basically, what you're looking at when you start when you take out the shootout and start counting things as 1 point for the tie, at the end of regulation and still with the pity point, it's the middle of the pack that starts to really shuffle around.
Yeah, pretty much is goes. I mean, it varies slightly. Because some teams have won more games in overtime than others, and it's kind of ridiculous, actually, seeing some teams' regulation records versus not. But yeah, you start to see, like, the Islanders, who are, or were, on December 9th, technically 500, and they're suddenly 483. And Florida is, like, down a whole bunch. And what it actually starts to affect is everybody's favorite system beyond looking at who's in the top eight, who's in the bottom five. And you get some more interesting scenarios. So, again, December 9th, when I looked at this last, we had Philadelphia in 27th place overall, which would actually have gotten them a lottery pick. They were a 500 team. The bottom four being Anaheim, Toronto, Florida, and Carolina. That pretty much stuck no matter what system you used. But Philadelphia had it for a while, and then if you switch to just wins, losses, and ties, so no charity point, no overtime points whatsoever, suddenly St. Louis is there. And then the more crazy three-point system, where three for a win, two for an overtime or shootout win, one for an overtime or shootout loss, and zero for a loss, Montreal drops down to there, and they were in 20th at the time in the current league standings. And suddenly, you know, they've got a shot at one of the top three or four picks. This gets a little crazier when you go into some previous years. In 2007, 2008, for instance, Edmonton had possibly the most disgusting record I have ever seen in this era. Regulation-wise, they were 22-35. But that's okay because they played 25 overtime games and were 15-4 on the shootout.
I remember that, yeah.
To date, Ottawa has 13 shootout wins in the 5 years that the shootout's been around.
In the 5 years?
Yeah, the combined 5 years. Ottawa's 13-26, and Edmonton got 15 wins in that season alone.
Wow.
So Edmonton actually finished, at that point, 20th. Which, you know, gets you a bottom 10 pick. Well, if you go to the old systems, wins, losses, and ties, Edmonton's 25th. And you go to a three-point system, and Edmonton's back up to 24. And they just kind of float around there, but at one point, they can actually get a lottery pick. They were down there far enough that they could have had a chance at a really good player. But they didn't.
Yeah.
So it screws you in some ways, and it also does some really wonderful things for you. Like, gives you a chance at the playoffs, but it can also take away a shot at a pick. And since everybody is really obsessed over the top five draft picks...
Well, you got to have something to shoot for, I guess.
Yeah.
I know how it felt last year when with the Colorado Avalanche, and of course, you know, they got... they got the third overall pick, which was the first time they've even come close to picking that high. And so, you know, at least you have something to shoot for, which to me, I guess, is to me, it seems like they're like the league has essentially come up with in their point system what is, I would say, almost gold in a way for in the ability to create something with the fans that previously was non-existent, and that is feeling good about a loss. And when you have if you're going to overtime or if you go to the shootout, at least, you know, teams who win can walk away saying, "Hey, we had a win." And teams who don't win and lose in overtime or the shootout say, "At least we got a point out of it." And to me, that seems almost as much about a marketing ploy as it does a way of, I guess charity, I guess rewarding somebody for making it 60 minutes into a game. Yeah. Is that just me? Does that make any sense at all?
It does in a way. The more vocal and hardcore fans, those of us who are parts of the blogosphere and really, really get into the communication and dealing with one another, we still feel like junk with a charity point.
Mm.
It's like, yeah, okay, we didn't get the win and we got a point, but here's if we had like played really well in this other 20-minute period, probably could have actually gotten the win.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of how it's viewed more. What the NHL was really going for was to give the fans the opportunity to see a winner every night and also to increase parity. So we'll give every team as much of a chance as possible to make the playoffs and keep the races nice and tight.
Mm-hmm.
But looking over...
Well, one of the things, of course, you know, we're also talking about is that, you know, you and I keep bringing up 500, and what does 500 mean? And really, that's kind of, you know, I've heard that debate for a couple of years now, is what exactly does 500, you know, being a 500 team mean? It, you know, does it mean that you have X amount of points versus X amount of games? What does win loss mean? That's part of the confusion, I think, of the charity point in a way also.
Well, the 500 determination, I mean, there's two different systems. There's points percentage and there's wins percentage.
Mm-hmm.
Win percentage is being how many games did you win out of the number played. But when you say a 500 team, it means that they have half the number of the possible points that they could have at any given time.
Right.
Which is how, at one point, you had in the West one team below 500, and that was Anaheim. Just one. And they were only like a point or two below the magical 500 mark at the time. So it also has created situations where talk show hosts, particularly in Toronto, I'm not gonna take too many digs at the Toronto media here, but it was a Toronto focused show, and they pointed out that with a win, Toronto could pull up to, you know, within 1 or 2 points of a playoff spot. But as of that point, they were still 29th in the league, and they're in the weaker Eastern Conference.
Right, but yeah, of course, that was still pretty early on, and you know there wasn't much separation at all, but still, yeah.
Actually, that was last week.
That was just last week?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yikes.
It's been a bit of a crazy, crazy system. But one thing I want to point out, when looking at tiebreakers and the impact that, you know, the overtime win and the shootout win can have on records and playoff implications, the one thing that got a lot of people kind of upset last year was that Montreal made the playoffs in 8th with the exact same record as Florida, based in the end on the goals for and goals against differential, went to the very end of the tiebreaker. So a lot of people thought that Florida was a better team and Montreal managed to squeak in based on some crazy NHL system of points that rewarded a bad team. Now, I've gone through all of these different systems, and the thing I've noticed is Montreal always makes the playoffs.
Hmm.
Florida finishes 7th. So they jump 2 spots, and it's actually the Rangers who get kicked down.
Really?
Yeah, and I was expecting it to be, you know, just a complete swap, where Montreal would go to 9th, and Florida would go to 7th, or to 8th, and the Rangers would just kind of sit where they were at 7th. But that's really not the case at all. And then a couple of years back, Ottawa had their amazing 15-2 start at the beginning of the year and then had the giant catastrophe of a season. And barely on the last day of the season, because Boston lost, they equaled in points and Ottawa won the tiebreaker and finished in 7th. And that's the last time they've been to the playoffs. But if you go to the old win-loss tie system, so no overtime points at all, Ottawa finishes 4th in the conference still. And you start to get different matchups in the playoffs, which in some ways can really affect things. Like last year, San Jose played Anaheim. if you had gone to the system pre-lockout, they would have played Minnesota, which meant that they probably would have had a chance to at least make it to the second round for once.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a couple scenarios 2 years ago where Detroit ended up playing Colorado instead of Colorado playing Minnesota. But we got that in the second round anyway and saw how that went. Thank you, Johan Franzen.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you, the injury bug and maybe some flu and yeah, on and on and on. Anyways, do we have to talk about that series?
That was a very sad one.
Yeah, it was
very sad. But, you know, things work out sometimes. Actually, under every single point system that I have looked at last year, Colorado still would have finished at absolute worst, third last. So they would have had a top three pick, period.
Yeah.
Although if you went to the old win-loss-tie system or the three-point system, Toronto gets the fifth pick and therefore, by default, gets the other Shen.
Ah.
Which would have made a lot of them very happy.
Yeah, because they picked seventh overall, is that correct?
Yeah, they got to seventh overall despite trying to move up and took Nazem Kadri, who, in all fairness, seems to be having a heck of a year in junior and really flashy kid and looks like he could be a pretty good piece on their forward systems for the next couple of years, you know, to complement, Kessel.
Well, there is the Kessel factor. That's always going to be that's going to be a factor for years to come, and positive and negative. So, of all these systems that basically you're looking at, I mean, maybe it's not really a good question to ask, but which one seems, and I think this is kind of what it all boils down to, in a way, which one seems the most fair? Does a 3-point system seem more fair?
Well, personally, I'm in the same category as Wyszynski and a lot of other people here, which is I don't like the charity point. I don't like the shootout. Mm-hmm. So I'd be just as happy to go back and have ties if for no other reason than you could take a look at a game and say, you know what, I really hate both these teams, so I hope they tie. That way neither one gets 2 points.
Uh-huh.
Whereas now you look at it and you actually have to go, ugh, I'm going to stomach somebody getting 2 points, and please don't go to overtime.
Yeah. Which I've had that exact same scenario, not only many times, but also having it a couple of times in the past several seasons where I've actually needed or wanted the Red Wings to win, and it felt dirty, it felt wrong, it was painful, I didn't like it.
Yeah, I've had that feeling as well. Yeah. You see a Detroit Calgary game, usually in the old systems, you would just say, okay, get a tie, just 1 point each. And now somebody has to win.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody has to inch upwards. But to be fair, the NHL is trying to push for the common fan to have wins. Right? There's going to be a winner every game. And as much as I'm a traditionalist, I don't want trophies renamed, I think the 3-point system is actually going to be the way to go. That way, there is going to be exactly, you know, the ability to get a 500 record,
mm-hmm.
because there will be an equal number of points distributed in each game. There's incentive to try to win it in regulation. And there's incentive also to just at least get a tie in there. So it can kind of pull both ways. But if you can win in regulation, you can seal it away. That'd be great. Because right now you have games where an Eastern Conference team plays a Western Conference team. And unless they're both at the very bottom and going for that lottery pick, why worry about going to overtime, really?
Right.
You
right, because who cares about where that point goes?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
If you both get a point, well, great, it's helping both of you, as opposed to, you know, trying to take a point away from a division rival.
Mm-hmm.
So honestly, I think 3-point system.
I think the 3-point system seems like the one that that basically has that evens out the games, that no game is going to essentially wind up more important than another game, which is what seems to happen now. You know, you have a 2-point game, you have a 3-point game. Well, which one was more important? Well, the 3-point game, obviously, you know, and wherever you, yes, where, who needed those 2 points more, you know, who lost, but really, you know, you're essentially waiting these games into being more important than others.
And that's completely true. And they tried out the two referee system in the AHL. They tried out a couple of other things in the AHL. Why not give it a shot there? Or
yeah.
Even the ECHL. Teams have affiliates down there, so they should have some sort of sway.
Mm-hmm.
Why not go for it? Just give it a shot. See what happens.
Yeah, I remember during the lockout year, they tried in the AHL, they tried 2-foot-wide blue lines in an attempt to basically create more ice, a few feet in each zone, essentially. And they wound up not using it, which I kind of wish that they had, but they tried it, and you're exactly right. You know, if you have a system that's available to do that in, you might as well give it a shot.
And that's what the AHL has been for. I mean, it's a farm team, sure, for player growth, but why not farm out possible different systems?
Yeah.
It can't hurt.
See, I think, to me, I wonder that if part of the problem of a three-point system isn't that it's more or less fair or more or less, a good way, bad way of doing things. But it seems essentially that what we're talking about really is, is it easy or hard to get hockey fans on board for? I think that the shootout was easier to get fans on board for than a three-point system would be.
I think it was easier to get behind because it was aimed not at the fans who've been following the system or the game for years, because they're going to stick around pretty much no matter what.
Right.
Even post-lockout. I mean, the NHL rebounded a lot better than Major League Baseball did after a work stoppage,
mm-hmm.
as far as fans regaining interest. And the shootout has done a lot of good for actually getting more people interested who wouldn't necessarily be interested before. They know they're going to see the win, and that was the purpose behind it. And three-point systems, it's more confusing.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly to anybody who's ever looked at hockey standings before. And it really does bother traditionalists. And I think part of that is that people like the record books. People like saying, this team, this Montreal team, got X number of points, and it's the most number of points that any team has had ever. Mm-hmm. The moment you switch systems, then you can't be comparing those records anymore.
Right.
And yeah, hockey is fairly traditionalist in that way.
Yeah, no, it is. I think you have a very good point that you would be basically blowing out the record books, every year for several years. And really people don't want to do that. all the time. I mean, it's great for the moment, but then what are you going to do to top it next? It's almost like saying, how many Winter Classics can you have in a year? How many are you going to fit in there?
3. And Ty Conklin must play in each one.
How do we get Ty Conklin on a plane from here to there? How do we trade Ty Conklin after this Winter Classic so he can go play in that Winter Classic? How do we do it?
I think we should do it as Winter Classic heritage teams, made up of the best players who played in previous Winter Classics. That way, Ty Conklin can get in as many as humanly possible. I mean, he's really screwing up the entire Hockey Gods plan right now.
Mm-hmm.
Sitting there in Minnesota, St. Louis.
Okay. How is he going to play in the Winter Classic and lose a Stanley Cup in the Stanley Cup Finals, which is what's happened over the last couple of years?
Well, see, this is the thing, is Hossa has got 2 years straight where he's lost,
mm-hmm.
and Conklin has 3 in 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So this means that Chicago is going to lose in the finals this year, and St. Louis is going to finish and lose in the finals next year, or whomever they trade Conklin to will do that.
What if it's almost nearly impossible at this, nearly impossible at this point, but what if we saw a St. Louis Blues versus Chicago Blackhawks conference finals to see who gets to lose the Stanley Cup in the next, at the end of the year?
I would really, really enjoy that. But St. Louis would have to pick up their game a little bit.
A little?
Well, I probably shouldn't be saying that sitting here in Vancouver, where St. Louis handed Vancouver right back to themselves on a platter last night. But yeah, they have got some ground to make up for sure.
Yeah, and then again, St. Louis still has the least amount of goals for of any team in the conference. And although they have pretty low goals against comparatively, Vancouver still has 110 goals for. St. Louis has 84 goals for.
Good Lord, that's awful.
Yeah, that's horrible.
I would have expected Columbus to be down there, but Columbus has a really solid 19 goal lead on them.
Yeah, and when they can't win at home. Blues can't win at home right now with a 6-11-2 record as of this Monday, December 21st. So that's
Wow.
I wouldn't feel too bad about the Canucks game last night. It could have been just an aberration at this point.
Actually, it's becoming kind of a common thing here. It's every time they have a chance to jump a little bit ahead in the standings and maybe hit that eighth place, you know, under current system rules.
Make people say things like, hey, it's going to be another storybook year, or oh, what a great start. Maybe not. Maybe not.
Pretty much.
Yeah. So I do want to talk to you a bit about the Ottawa Senators because because I normally talk about the Ottawa Senators with Tom Luongo, my co-host, and he doesn't like the Senators. So it's nice.
He's a Sabres fan.
Yes, exactly. And it's nice to talk to somebody who, you know, with the other perspective, of course. But also I just want to encourage people that if anybody wants to weigh in on what they think about any of the systems that we've discussed, or have their own systems of points or what they think about the standings, they can either always go to www.rinkpodcast.com and leave a comment. Can also call us on the phone at 845-704-RINK. It's 845-704-7465, and play them on the next podcast. And Ryan, you're going to have you've been looking at a few other systems as well. And you're going to have more breakdowns on your blog at RyanClassic.net, right?
That is the hope. It's been a project that I've had to delay a little bit here and there, but I've got a bit of time in the next week, and I'm going to be putting that together.
It is the holidays.
It is the holidays. I'll be flying down to Ottawa tomorrow, actually.
Are you going to be able to take in any games while you're there?
You know, there's only one that's going to be there while I'm in town, and that is the Montreal game on the 29th. And unfortunately, the cheapest I could get was a $103 ticket.
That actually sounds like a pretty reasonable price for two Canadian teams in Canada at this point. Maybe not on a student budget at this point, but still.
Fair enough. What I made the mistake of doing was I booked my flights based on plans for what I wanted to do for New Year's. So I booked a December 30th afternoon flight to come back to Vancouver, not realizing that December 30th is when Colorado is playing in Ottawa. Which, those are my two teams there. Mm-hmm. And a little bit heartbreaking to miss out on that. And I'll even be on a plane while they're playing, so I can't even really watch them. I'm going to DVR that.
If the Senators are playing the Avalanche, then who do you want to win? That's the question.
Ottawa in a shootout or overtime. Let's get that 3-point thing working for me.
Exactly what we were talking about.
Well, Ottawa needs the points more, honestly.
Well, and here's the thing, and we talk about goal differential, and the Senators are actually on the losing end of the goal differential, and are still in the playoff slot right now. They're sitting at seventh. They have 100 goals for and 103 against.
They don't tend to blow out teams.
No.
And they tend to lose 3-1 or 4-1. And actually, that could be 100-100 if Brian Elliott hadn't flubbed at least 3 goals over the last 14 games or so that he played.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit brutal. to be quite honest. Since Leclerc's been out, they put all the load on Elliott. And the guy got a little bit tired. There was one crazy spot where they were on the West Coast. They played in Los Angeles on a Friday. It was on Friday. And then on Sunday, they played this Friday, something along those lines. Anyway, played in LA one night. And then two nights later, they played in Phoenix. And the very next night, they played in Anaheim. And they were starting a game in Anaheim 17 hours after the one that they had just played in Phoenix.
Mm.
And Elliott got all three starts. And lo and behold, the Anaheim game, which Ottawa did win 4-3 in a shootout, they held 1-0, 2-1, and 3-2 leads for a combined total of 96 seconds.
Hmm.
It was completely unreal to watch. You know, get a goal, hooray! And you know, you look down to type something over Twitter or on a live thread on a blog, and you look up, and all of a sudden it's tied again.
Yeah. Well, the weird part about the Pascal Leclerc injury was that it happened while he was on the bench. Took a puck right in the jaw and broke his jaw?
Sitting on the bench, puck deflected off a stick, hit him in the jaw, broken jaw, out for over a month. This is the goalie who has had nothing but health problems with hips and knees, and you know, finally seems to be recovered and playing decently well. Mm-hmm. And holy snake bitten Batman.
Yeah.
It's just really, really unfortunate. And so everything went to Brian Elliott for quite a while, denying the world my favorite backup goalie, Mike Not Martin Brodeur.
Now, this is Mike Brodeur.
No relation.
No relation. And he's pretty much been sitting in the AHL for a while now, hasn't he?
A few years on and off. He has played for 4 ECHL teams and 3 AHL teams, has been signed by 3 NHL teams, and this was his first ever call-up.
Wow.
And he spent the better part of a month just sitting on the bench. And then finally, they put him in the game against Minnesota when Minnesota had, you know, completely new equipment, thanks to a nice little fire in the back of a truck. And he gets his first NHL game, his first NHL win, his first NHL first star, and overall had a really good night.
Yeah.
And completely excited.
Didn't he get a shutout out of the night?
He almost did. It was 22-23 saves, or 22 saves on 23 shots. Got into the third period with the shutout and just couldn't do it. Played a heck of a game, though, and particularly worth noting that the other Brodeur, you know, the one that everybody else knows, who's played 1,030 more starts, no more games than Mike, let in 3 goals on 6 shots that night.
Yeah.
What really kind of saddened me is that Ottawa's coach seems to have just a thing against fun little anecdotes, because the previous night, Ottawa was playing in New Jersey, and this was the game where Brodeur finally beat Patrick Waugh's record for most games played. And Corey Clouston had the opportunity to have that game's score sheet say at the end, M. Brodeur versus M. Brodeur. But no love.
And who won that game that night?
That would be Jersey.
That would be Jersey, yeah.
Jamie Langenbrunner seems to own the Senators.
Which, by the way, I guess we should mention that on this night, as we're recording Monday, December 21st, Martin Brodeur breaks the shutout record with 104 shutouts against the defending Stanley Cup champions, the Pittsburgh Penguins.
Well, kudos to him for that, then.
Yeah. Congratulations to him. Anyways, moving on from that. well, now you've seen it living in Vancouver, and with coaches that love to just ride a guy and ride a guy, and in my, to me, it means that what you're looking at is not just, you know, a guy that's getting worked and worked and worked and maybe even overworked, but you're also looking at a guy on the bench who doesn't have the opportunity to play enough and get his, you know, get his game legs. And that's important. I mean, we've been watching that in Colorado where, apparently they don't have the faith in Peter Budaj, and Craig Anderson gets start after start after start, even back to back road starts. And, you know, it just amazing to me. You know, so now that, this other Brodeur, the not Marty Brodeur, has gotten his start and gotten his win, do you think that they're going to that they'll ease up a little bit and allow him to play a little more?
Well, I would hope so, but looks like Pascal Leclerc is going to be coming back on their next game on Wednesday. But hopefully it gives him some faith in, if he does have to get called up again, in when Leclerc inevitably gets injured again, that they might actually give him a start.
Yeah.
Or two starts. And you're seeing the same thing in Edmonton right now with Javi Boulin out indefinitely and Jeff Drouin-Delorier. JDD has played every game since Javi went down. He got pulled once after getting absolutely annihilated in the first period against Vancouver.
Mm.
And we saw the NHL debut of Devan Dubnyk, who has then sat on the bench ever since.
Wow. That's... Yeah, and that, and you know, of course, Javi Boulin, he gets, you know, a contract that everybody thought was too long, especially for a guy his age. And
it's look an what over 35 contract.
Mm. Yep.
As long as he doesn't retire, then that contract is still on the books, and it's a serious handicap for Edmonton because they don't have a lot of space left.
They don't have a lot of space left, and they have a lot. They don't have a lot else right now. They're the bottom of the conference. They're obviously not bottom of the league because Carolina Hurricanes are doing everything they can to hold on to that.
They're bottom of the conference after having a 5-game road win streak.
Ouch. Yeah.
Yeah. They've
not
been so good on the offense lately. I mean, Elishemsky went down and everyone expected them to stop scoring.
Mm-hmm.
And then they kind of did. And you can only go so far on a backup goalie who's just honestly playing really well, but too many starts, not enough scoring coming from a lot of the guys who they do have. And, you know, a lot of other key pieces are injured. Mike Comrie was brought in to be some insurance scoring, and he's got mono. He's had mono for quite a while now, so he's not playing. And at one point, after the 21-game mark, Edmonton had 105 man games lost injury, so they were averaging 5 regulars out a game a quarter into the season. So their year is looking like it's going to be completely awash, and honestly, I don't think that's a bad thing for the team. It's like Colorado. They had their one bad year, and they got some really good picks for it. It looks like they've got a real bona fide great player in Duchesne. The unfortunate thing is if Joe Sakic hadn't met face-to-face or hand-to-hand with a snowblower, Colorado wouldn't have Duchesne.
Going for the easy joke there. Going for the easy one. I understand.
Pointing out that if Sakic had not had a senior moment, there would be no Matt Duchesne here.
Chances are you're right. Yep, that's true. I guess it's the upside that you look on when you lose a player like that. That but still, you know,
yeah. Kind of disappointed me because I had tickets to see a Colorado San Jose game, and it was supposed to be my last chance to see Sakic, and well, he didn't get to play.
Right. Yeah.
Instead, I got Andrew Raycroft. And you mentioned about Luongo getting a whole bunch of starts here in Vancouver. Well, that's because the alternative is Raycroft.
Well, it's one of the alternatives. The other alternative, of course, is Corey Schneider.
And that was the...
Schneider you'd think would get thing. A little more time.
Well, when Luongo did get injured, they rode Raycroft. And it wasn't until the very last game where they decided to give Schneider a start. And this is the guy they're supposed to be possibly showcasing for teams in order to pull off some trade to get, you know, a rental player for the playoffs or somebody who they can stick in a spot long term to replace, say, the production of a Kyle Wellwood or lack thereof, who is pretty much inevitably going to end up on waivers at this point. So Schneider is supposed to be the blue chip prospect, and they didn't bother showing him off either. And I know for a lot of Vancouver fans, this was a really, really frustrating thing to sit through. And they want their team to win.
Yeah.
They want to see what they have in the farm system. They want to be able to have something that they can possibly trade. And Schneider gets one start. And the team hung him out to dry.
Well, I did want to ask you, I wanted to get back to the Senators a little bit, because I did want to ask you, with all the problems that Pascal Leclerc has had with injuries, with Mike Brodeur getting his first win, does any of it really matter when Mike Fisher and Carrie Underwood are finally going to get married? Are you happy that that's happening? Aren't you glad that that's what the Senators news on NHL.com is right now?
I'm glad that it's going to mean that a couple people in the United States who had no idea what Ottawa was, well, at least they'll know they have a hockey team, if nothing else. Bring a little bit more visibility into there. It brings a little bit of, I guess, a spectacle to the team, but any Senators broadcast you watch right now is inevitably going to have one or two very candid shots of Carrie Underwood sitting in the audience, eating popcorn. She no longer ducks out of the camera view like she did initially last year.
What would be the point of ducking out if you're a celebrity, you're not used to that, or what?
You know, I didn't understand that either, because about 2 days after I found out that they were, you know, an item, and being a Senators fan, I was living in San Francisco at the time, and popped out of my apartment, and there was a giant truck delivering vitamin water with a giant Carrie Underwood picture on it. So I figure she can handle being on camera if she can handle being on delivery trucks.
Yeah, for vitamin water, of all things.
But honestly, actually, since, well, at least this year, I don't know how much of it you can attribute to Miss Underwood, or I guess soon to be Mrs. Carrie Fisher.
Oh, I hadn't even thought of that.
You know, geeks everywhere are about to.
It's not going to happen. I don't even think she's going to hyphenate.
But actually, Fisher's had a heck of a year. I believe he's already surpassed his goal total from last year in a fraction of the number of games. And with Jason Spezza out, he's now more or less the number one center. So maybe this is really good for him.
Maybe it's the fact that he's happy
in other parts of his life, and
maybe it's the fact that Hillary Duff isn't around to distract him anymore.
You know, I'm actually wondering, what's she doing now with Mike Comrie having mono?
Ooh, I hadn't even thought of that. He has mono? Living in
Edmonton. Yeah, mononucleosis. He's been out for most of the year.
I hadn't even realized.
He had a great preseason.
I hadn't even realized. I was wondering why things were so quiet on that front, but I guess now we know. Isn't mono called the kissing disease? Is that what it is?
It's called the kissing disease.
And what's his butt, Steve Mason had it from Columbus. I remember last season. I remember
Mason managed to handle it a little better than Mike did.
He played
Truett and shadowed Ovechkin, whereas Comrie went to bed.
I don't even know if he's
hanging around the press box or not. I'm not sure what he's doing.
I don't know if I'd keep that. I don't know if I'd keep him in there anywhere near the team if he still had it.
You just cut out there.
So no more Duffer, and you're going to have the Mike Fisher Carrie Underwood wedding, and that. I mean, that's been pretty much what the media center of, Ottawa Senators has been, you know, the two celebrity girlfriends.
To be honest, besides Heatley Gate,
yeah,
there hasn't been a whole lot going on with the team. Mm-hmm. And don't get me wrong, I love my team. It's something I've got built into me now. I've been with them since the very beginning. But I have a much easier time watching Colorado play. And due to the fact that a close friend of mine has a cousin playing in Tampa Bay, and a former neighbor of mine also plays down there, I watch them a fair bit, and I find them more entertaining than Ottawa. The Senators have Mahalik. Mahalik is very entertaining to watch. They have Alex Kovalev, who's very frustrating to watch. Words can't even really describe how painful that has become. And other than that, there's really not a whole lot there.
Yeah, even Chris Neal hasn't had as many penalty minutes as some of the others. I guess he's out.
He's still injured too. He's been out for quite a while. I think he was both third or fourth in penalty minutes per game average for a while, and then he's out. Maybe that's also why Mike Fisher is playing better, because the two of them are really good friends. So if Chris isn't there to distract him,
he can focus on his play.
He can focus on play and Underwood.
Well, what about Jonathan Chichu? I mean, he's not putting up much right now. I mean, nine points, three of goals.
Well, the thing is, Chichu was awful to begin the year. He's never been a good skater, and that's been more and more evident since he began to play in Ottawa. And then a funny thing happened. He played a game in San Jose. Mm-hmm. And since that swing, he's actually been really, really good. They've got him paired on the line with Jarkko Ruutu, who's been getting a number of points. And this is one of those cases where what's on the score sheet doesn't necessarily reflect what's actually going on. So Chichu, at least one game recently, was minus one, but was a major part in getting at least three really good scoring chances and setting up a goal purely by taking out players behind the net. So you can give him a lot of credit for the goal, but he gets nothing statistically for it. But since the San Jose game and the subsequent Los Angeles, Phoenix, and Anaheim games, and ever since coming back from that, Chichu has actually been not too bad. Now, not too bad does not mean 56 goal scorer, but you take what you can get.
Yeah.
And with Chichu, really, that's actually more than we were expecting to get.
Which is kind of sad considering what you were giving up. But then again, you were giving up a guy who just didn't want to be there, so...
And it's interesting what happens when you've got a situation like that. I know when Scotty Wasilewski was on, he just kind of had the feeling, same as I did, that just get this stupid saga over with. But since then, you have... People in Ottawa were really enamored with our top line. We had Spezza, we had our Alfredson, and we had Healy. And they were all heroes. Mm-hmm. Healy is not looked upon fondly at all anymore. It's gone from him being a really, really good part of the team, a major point producer, into suddenly becoming enemy number one, and anything he did well for the team now has a giant black scar on it. And honestly, I think it comes down to nothing more than the man has never once apologized for any of it. If he had simply said, "I'm sorry, this is just a personal matter, and I want to deal with it this way, and I need to be away from the team for this and this reason," that would have been a lot better. That's what he did in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. When the trade happened for the Hossa swap, it came out immediately that he had requested a trade because he needed, for his own sake, a change of scenery. And what's happened since then, since trade request with Ottawa, is he's done nothing of that. He's never apologized to the fans of Edmonton or the fans of Ottawa. All he's done is called them, the great fans of Canada, and they're very passionate. But he's never once said, "Look, I'm sorry, but this was the decision I needed to make." And that would have made a complete world of difference.
Even if he didn't mean it, even if he didn't believe it.
Anything would have helped. Instead, you've got his father making comments about how you can never get a proper opinion or report from somebody in Ottawa, because all the reporters there know who signs their paychecks. So never get an unbiased opinion. And it's a real shame, because that means the true story will never come out. He made these comments to a San Francisco Chronicle staff writer for an article that was released only in the San Francisco Chronicle. To have been a perfect time to not be hypocritical. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, you know, that's in the past. And the one thing that actually has been fairly entertaining has been Milan McCollum. I touched on that a moment ago, but he has been, well, great. He's fun to watch. The guy has an amazing amount of speed, and it's just really entertaining to watch him just suddenly break out of nowhere and dart down the ice. And even if he's not producing fantastically, I mean, he's on pace for over 30 goals, mm-hmm. at least he's entertaining. And sadly, that's more than I can say for a lot of Ottawa this year. And it pains me to say that. It yeah. really does.
Well, yeah, I can imagine.
But at least this time, there's no Andrew Raycroft on any of my teams.
No, you, but since you live in Vancouver, you just have to watch him. You have to see him locally. It's not like he's going to get a lot of time, yeah. Wow. Well, Ryan, I really appreciate it. I appreciate you coming on and talking about talking some stats with me, talking some centers. It was great. Of course, your blog is called The Classic Blog. It's at ryanclassic.net. And remind me on Twitter, you are Ryan Classic.
Ryan Classic, all one word.
Excellent. Ryan runs the Classic Blog and is going to have a lot more stats going up later on, maybe at the end of the week, maybe the week after that, and we'll see how things shake out. Thanks a lot, Ryan.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
That does it for this week's episode of The Rink. The Rink can always be found at www.rinkpodcast.com, where you can find links to anything we talked about today. You can leave a comment or subscribe to us in iTunes. You can call The Rink at 845-704-RINK. That's 845-704-7465. And you can email us at rink@rinkpodcast.com. Thanks a lot for listening to The Rink.